Station number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 20.
Mr. Armstrong, reel 20. You were now building tented camps for the invasion, Mr. Armstrong.
That's correct. And it was the most important time for the British and the Allied forces to be fully prepared for the invasion, which we began to realise was going to be fairly soon. But all the other sorts of work had to go off. Roads had to be laid into these camps because of the traffic. Hard standings had to be made for tanks, which, if you can picture it, were coming down right from Scotland. I remember my wife telling me she was living on the A1 road. And she said for 3 days and nights, the tanks didn't stop passing their house, our house in Durham. And when they halted, people were running out of the houses and giving the crews tea. That was particularly what they used to like, tea. And I suppose there would be biscuits and the rest of it. But tea was the great thing because the pauses were so often so short that there was only time to take tea from the people and then away it moved again. And she said it was then that she guessed what was happening, that it was then brewing up. And I often wonder, when you think that this was happening right up about 300 miles away, that the Germans literally didn't appear to have an inkling of what was happening. They knew there was to be an invasion, but they were hoodwinked into thinking it was coming from Dover. Fascinating. Anyhow, we hadn't a lot to do in our spare time because it was so limited. And so we used to go over our equipment. And I remember one of our newer officers, a very, very nice chap, big, over 6 foot, chartered engineer, just out of university had joined us. And we got on very well and we were sharing a hut. And one day I came into the hut and he was sitting playing with a fuse. And I said, "George, that isn't very sensible." He said, "Oh, I'm just looking for the safety device." And I said, "There isn't one. The British fuses don't have them." "Oh," he said, "they must have." I said, "Look, George, if you're going to be stupid, while you just let me have a walk around the camp while you blow yourself to kingdom come." I was so incensed. I walked out and I'd got about 50 yards and all of a sudden there was a woof. I ran back and George was standing. You can imagine the state he was in. He'd lost his hands and his face was all bloody, and he looked at me and he said, the last words he said were, "You were right, Paul."
What was his name?
George. And well, Weston was his name, because the next day the colonel, everybody was shocked, and Colonel Bryden paraded the whole unit and said, "Mr. Weston's blown himself to kingdom come. He was a bloody fool. He wouldn't listen to what Mr. Armstrong had to tell him, and he's dead. In future, try and listen to people who know what they're talking about. If in doubt, ask." The chaps thought he was a bit harsh, but he wasn't. It was sensible, and it made them a little bit more careful than they were before, because everyone gets used to things. Dangerous things are not. If you think of miners dice with death many a time, but it's use and familiarity. It's the old story. It breeds contempt, and this what happened. I had 3 fatalities during my service in England before I went abroad. One was totally unnecessary, just the explosion of a grenade, and forgetting that you only had 4 seconds to remove yourself. Silly things, but people tend to forget. I can't say that we were given anything, any spare time at all. It was full tilt going. I've explained to you that you had hard standings to make for vehicles, which were all lined up, which were all camouflaged. Obviously we used the trees where we could in this area, because the area around Havant and district at that time was very, very well wooded. And everyone had the camouflage netting that was used, and we had to put water points up for these vehicles. Major, sit. Good boy. And there are so many things that go towards making a camp like this, and trying to remember that you have to be hidden from observation, that I think it was a miracle that people cooperated so much.
Did you have any air activity from the Germans?
None. Whilst I was there, quite wrong. There was only, I can remember, 3 occasions when one heard aircraft, but they were so high there was little observation, because the Air Force was moving round the whole time, backwards and forwards and away over the channel. It was really an incredible sight. Well, of course, the camp started filling in, and that, of course, was where our problems arose. People were saying they hadn't adequate water points, the standings weren't sufficient, and we were literally run off our feet. Until one day we got the signal that we were being slotted into our situation in the invasion. And so we moved into this camp, and I can remember, very interesting, they were primitive. That's one thing I will say about the British Army. It doesn't pamper its troops. The British Army works on the theory that the less you spend on a soldier, the better. And that's, although it sounds harsh to say it, that is literally what happened in the preparation for the invasion. And I remember these chaps that moved in with us at the same time, different units were around us, playing hell, saying, if we could lay our hands on the people that build these, we would certainly do A, B and C to them. And my colonel used to nudge me and say, what about it? We kept very, very quiet. And in fact, it was interesting, because next to us there was a chap from the Dental Corps, and he was so thrilled about this beautiful caravan equipped out, he insisted that I go and have a look at it. And in fact, he was so pleased, he said, you must have some sort of a damaged tooth. Let me try it out. I said, no, thank you. I want to keep all the equipment that I've got as long as I can. But that's the sort of thing that was happening. All sorts of units were around.
About what time did you have your position in the invasion allocated to you?
Oh, just towards the end of May.
This was the whole unit?
The whole unit, yes. Yes, we were all ready. But
were they British troops in these camps?
Yes, we were with the British troops, yeah. And not very far away from us was 50, Dave. But unfortunately, we were all inside this closed area with literally military police were keeping the whole of the perimeter under observation. No one could get out. I mean, no one could get out.
Did that give you any problems with your men?
We didn't have any problems. We knew that the invasion was coming. There were people whose wives were pregnant and things like that who wanted to go. But when you saw the people circling, it was a closed camp.
Would they have actually shot someone or tried to get out? Would they have gone as far as that, do you think?
Well, you see, in the British Army, if you shoot somebody, they hang you. So I don't think they would get that far, but they apprehended anyone that did try to get out. And so, knowing the peculiarity of the British Army, I don't remember anybody trying. But a strange thing happened. It was a matter of, I think I'm right in saying, the week before the invasion, the first of the V1 bombs started coming over. It was either a week or a fortnight before. It was literally within the last, well, within the last 2 weeks. And we got a signal that we had to leave the camp. All of us, the complete unit. Nobody had the slightest idea what was happening. But, as I say, my colonel must have had influence in high places, because we were sent to Sevenoaks. And we drove straight non-stop from Portsmouth to Sevenoaks, as fast as we could lick. Every man Jack left taken out. It was quite absurd, taken out of that, and we didn't know anything about the business of the V. We'd heard there was V1s, obviously it was on the radio, but didn't occur to us what was it. And we were sent out to Sevenoaks, and we'd followed some other people into a camp that they'd vacated. I remember it was very makeshift. And then the colonel told us that our job was to recover a V1 intact. So that was a fascinating thought. And what happened, of course, was we had our maps showing right down to the coast at Shoeburyness, right back again up to the capital. And what we tried to do, we tried to put the men out in small groups so that if any came down and didn't explode, they could radio straight in and we would go to have a look at it. And I know I went down. I was acting as the colonel's adjutant at the time. I went down to Margate, Shoeburyness, you name it. We were all over the coast, worked our way up, and there were lots of them going over. And the very interesting, I noticed some of the RAF, instead of shooting them down, were literally nudging them with the wings to a side, so they turned off and went off harmlessly. It was fascinating. The RAF had some marvellous gentlemen amongst them. They did think, I wouldn't have dared do that. I would have said, right, shoot it down, full stop. But they had fun in their way. Anyhow, we'd been there, it can only have been a week, possibly 10 days. And we found one had gone down in a marsh, and about halfway between the coast and Sevenoaks. So we went there, took all our equipment, and we amongst the other things, I think I told you, we had a crane. We swung that round, and our little boat paddled across this marsh, located this thing, a little bit anxious, because no one knew anything about them. They just knew that it was a bomb that was pilotless, and that was all we knew. We had the boffins from the War Office saying, for God's sake, don't set it off, as though we were wanting to set it off. And we were desperately trying to raise it slightly to see how to get hold of it to start with. One never knew how to hold this thing in case we damaged something. Anyhow, you can picture the sight. It was quite surrealist. And we even tried pouring water on to clean it off to see what we had exposed. Amazing thing. If ever you get the chance, you should see a picture of one. They are amazing. Anyhow, eventually we got hoses round it, and in spite of the boffins, we raised it out and then swung it across to the land. Had to clean it off even then when we got it off, and then these people descended on it, and we were told, thank you very much. So the colonel said, well, I think we've earned ourselves a party. And I remember we had a party in the hotel in Sevenoaks, the biggest hotel there, and 3 o'clock in the morning we got word to say we had to go back and take our place in the invasion, which had started. And so drove back headlong speed. We must have been mad. Drove back at headlong speed into our camp near Havant. And by that time, pieces had been moving on, but we were literally slotted back into our position. And we got onto a boat, and the first thing that the colonel did was to go up to see the skipper, who was a friend of his from near Glasgow. A chap he knew very well. And we moved out from Portsmouth, and we were lying off the Isle of Wight, and there was a bit of a pause. You won't believe this. The old man persuaded the skipper to let us go ashore at Cowes for a pint. And I said, this is crazy. We'll be hanged if we're caught. Oh, he said, let them catch us. This is the last time we'll have of getting a drink.
Can I just ask you, had you been told in the time that we were in the camp, in your D-Day camp, had you been told what your role was to be?
No, not then.
Had anything been described to you?
We didn't get it until we came back and we were literally moving forward. And then the colonel was given his instructions. Don't forget, we weren't assault troops. We were what they called army troops, which don't go in the first wave. And wouldn't expect to. And so it was something, I'm not sure, I keep trying to remember, but there were such hectic days with running away and doing this V1 and then coming back. One lost touch with time. I remember as we were running back to the camp, we were bombed going through Streatham in London. But we didn't stop, we just drove on. Our lorries had masks over the lights, so that, and then they had a light underneath the axle so one could see the man in front. But we just kept going and we just pressed on. It was so urgent.
What date in the invasion program were you taking over to France?
Well, by the time we'd got back, it was somewhere D12, D13, D14, that sort of time. Because, as I say, we weren't assault troops. We would have been in the way. We were follow-up because the field engineers had a specific job to do and they couldn't drop anyone off to carry out any engineering tasks. So they were going forward and we were coming in to do, for instance, mine clearing and water supply laying, putting up accommodation, as we did, for nurses. We dug them slit trenches because they were above ground. You find that hard to believe, but the nurses were in so fast, the field ambulances were in so fast, that they literally, the bridgehead was bulging. There were so many people, it was like bursting out of a cork coming out of a bottle, trying people, they were still pushing people in behind, reinforcing, because it's hard to explain now. Even when I went, the weather in the channel wasn't very much fun. By that time, some of the block ships that had been sunk had been washed away. There was debris all over. It was really hard to get in. And one found it pretty hard work. So we were needed, but we weren't needed as fast as the assault troops.
How did you feel knowing that you were going into an invasion situation?
Well, it's a job to do. We'd been chased out in 1940. We'd been made to look such bloody fools then. We couldn't think that this invasion wasn't going to succeed. It was a marvellous deception plan. It was a job that couldn't be done a second time. If it didn't succeed this time, heaven knows how many years would be taken before anything could be done. So it was vital. And when you're doing a job like this, adrenaline comes forward, and I'm not brave, but the job in hand takes over, and you feel you're doing that particular job, and you haven't time. Besides which, you have all your men, and in the British Army, you looked upon, you expected to behave as the father and mother of these boys. And so you worry about them as well as worrying about your job. It doesn't leave you much time to be frightened.
And the attitude of the unit as a whole?
They were good. They were keen chaps. They knew what they trained for. They knew they were all professionals. We'd made them as I'd done my little bit to make them able to defend themselves if necessary. I'd made them learn how to shoot, to dig, to dig trenches even, which they'd never done before. But I made them carry out all these sort of jobs in training so that we would never be caught. Because, interestingly enough, the colonel and I were the only people who'd seen active service. Not another officer or man in the unit had seen any. So it wasn't terribly easy.
What was your immediate impression of that beach when you hit it, when you got to it?
Oh, it was massive. There was debris, yes, but in war, I had, don't forget, I'd watched villages and towns going up in France in 40. I'd seen a lot of damage. I'd worked in London. I once went to the War Office for an interview, arriving early in the morning because the trains didn't normally come in during the day. And as I walked along the road, glass was running like water down the gutters. When you've seen that, you don't bother a lot about debris. All I was interested was the chaps were over the beach. They were moving inland, and that's all we cared. We wanted to get in, give support.
Where did you land?
Arromanches.
Was it an organized scene? This huge...
When you have an... it sounds absurd. When you have any sort of a landing, there is what they call a beach master. And he has his team. Interestingly enough, they call it a beach brick, because each brick does a different job and slots together until it forms into a unit. And they are responsible for the smooth running of the operation. They would be the first to take a position and show people where they're going. Each unit, you see, your leading man has his unit sign as he puts out forward. And his assault sappers are going in with their, if possible, if humanly possible, you hope the flail tanks will go in. But to start with, you've got the poor infantrymen. They're the men that you take your hat off to. They've got the really hard work, because they don't know what is there. They can't afford the luxury of using, for instance, mine detectors. Actually, we didn't have any at the spare that time. We just had to rely on prodding, you see. That was the thing that mattered. mine detectors were just beginning to come in, but prodding with a bayonet. So you can imagine that the infantryman, as well as trying to find a position to fire from, has to be sure that he doesn't fall onto a mine while he's doing it, has to try and keep in the tracks that the engineers are rolling out tapes in areas that they've tracks that they've cleared. And you can imagine what a job that is alone. So it's rather, at the start, it appears to be chaotic, but there is a plan, and everyone must work to the plan, except that if you're held up in one place and someone on your left or right is able to get forward, you join them and take there so that you can get back onto your original line. This is the sort of thing, it's very fluid, but you can imagine how it's dovetailing in all the time.
So by the time that you got to the beach, things were organised and running efficiently on the beach itself?
Yes, the beach was clear. The bodies had been removed, in fact, by the time we got there. There were one or two waiting to be buried, but it had been cleaned up a bit. And there was lines then by that time. The white lines that had been taped out, there was where the cleared lines, where the flail tanks had gone through. They had all sorts of what they call the funnies, the engineers, and we, of course, had to follow up there. We didn't get very far forward, of course, at first. It was hemmed in because they were expecting the counterattack. So it would have been folly to get too far ahead, but they went as far as they could.
What happened to you when you got to the beach?
When we got to the
beach... Did you go off onto the beach itself, or was it on some of the
No, we were dropped onto tracking and went up on tracking. We were very fortunate, you see. The operation was astoundingly efficient. It was amazing. And you can tell by the casualties. There were so few casualties from what was expected that when one arrived there, it was amazing to see how rapidly people had organised themselves and were moving quietly forward. And in fact, the first job we got to do was, while we were waiting to be instructed by, it was Cor who would have instructed us, while waiting there, my colonel saw a field hospital, and about, there must have been up to 20 nurses with no cover. So immediately, while the chaps were kind of waiting, he immediately set them off digging slip trenches for these girls, pending any other accommodation. but it was only a tent. The hospital was a tented camp and these people were working in it. So we thought, the old man thought, if we build them slit trenches and there are any German aircraft, they can nip in there. So our first job was to build trenches for nurseries. The next job we had to do, while again we were still waiting for an official job to do, but due to the battering from the Navy, there was quite a lot of damage, not only to the German points, houses and so on, but the roads were pretty well hammered about, and we started straight away repairing the roads so that traffic could get ahead, because it's interesting, but one still needs roads. They didn't go off them because of the mines. They were sown in the grass verges. So you were literally stuck with the supplies. You were stuck with roads at one stage. And so we were repairing roads.